We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
And good morning and welcome to Focus. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you here. And we're also happy to have back on the program once again Kevin Waspy. He's a lecturer in the Department of Finance in the College of Business at the University of Illinois. He is really one of a couple of guys that on a fairly regular basis is here to talk about investing and money management issues. Dave Sinnoh is here most of the time. He has been taking a little time off this summer. I think he's probably fishing or something like that. Ably standing in for him has been Kevin. He was here with us last month, and we're glad to have him here again. And the idea of this program is a practical one. The idea is that people are going to have questions about their financial strategies, their plans, where they want to put their money, what makes sense. And this is a place that you can go to get one particular set of opinions. So you want to call in and ask whatever question you have. I know Kevin will do his best to help you out. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free. Save you some money on the call if it would be long distance. 800-222-9455. And you can also email your comments, questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. Hey, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me again, David. It's always fun. And to the best of my ability, I hope we get some calls and are able to talk a little bit about what's going on in a context of how it might help a person make financial-type decisions.
Well, anything generally that you know, it's sort of on your mind about where we are right now?
Well, I would only remind listeners that we continue in an era of extremely low interest rates. Mm-hmm. Those types of things are very frustrating to savers. It's probably, people that have heard me on the program in the past may be coming tired of hearing me say it, but this is not a time for people to try to stretch for yield and do things that might not work out in the long run just in an effort to get a higher rate of return at the moment. So, again, it's frustrating with very low interest rates, rates of return available for a person that needs to put their money away and basically hope for a rate of return.
Well, how far out do you feel okay going? Much past a year?
I don't feel a problem with going beyond a year as long as and this is another strategy that we've discussed in the past. As long as they can, as long as an investor can structure those deposits. So whether we talk about things like bonds, certificates of deposit, U.S. Treasury securities, any fixed income, fixed maturity obligation, I really do and feel that this time is just the poster child of all times where this strategy makes the most sense, and that is, obviously, we've talked about before, the ladder of maturities. So breaking the sum of money into four pieces, structuring it in a way where a quarter of it comes due perhaps every 6 months or every 12 months. And if you did a quarterly type of structure over a 12-month ladder spacing, you'd literally go out to the four-year category.
Okay. We have a caller here and would welcome others. Again, 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Up first, Terre Haute, line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question about the bond market, which you just made reference to. Most particularly, I'm concerned about bonds that are in somewhat dangerous areas. For example, the state of California has issued some bonds, the Detroit public school system. I'm just concerned about them, not only because of the volatility in those areas. The bonds that I have are insured, but I'm worried about the insurance companies as well. So that's, I guess, two questions. The third one is they have fixed income associated with them, but they do not come due for decades. And in one case, I think it's about 35 years. So I'm just would like to have your response to those very specific concerns. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. The general theme, or let me just start with an overview. Obligations of states or subdivisions of states are probably in the current environment more suspect to the possibility for downgradings of ratings, certainly more suspect for an ultimate potential in default than in any other time since the 1930s. Now, I don't want to sound alarm bells or have a person say that Kevin said the state of California is going to default on their general obligation bonds or anything like that. But in the current environment, the stress on states and local subdivisions of states, whether they're cities or school districts, so on and so forth, has probably never been stronger than 80 years ago. That said, given the purpose of those bonds being held, I would have to ask the caller, but they're no longer on the line, how they came upon the purchase of them or perhaps an inheritance, and how that fits their objectives in the current light. In other words, do you really need a 30, 35-year term to maturity fixed rate of interest security? Let me just couch it in this broad sense. We've already discussed how low interest rates are, and here's how a bond works in terms of a secondary market sale price. Everything else constant. The lower the interest rate in the market environment, the higher the price of the bond. Because the bond is a contract, if it has a fixed payment of interest, a fixed percentage rate, that rate becomes even more attractive to a potential buyer of the bond when market rates of interest, comparable interest rates in the environment, are lower. Therefore, the possibility exists that, depending on when they were acquired, the person might be able to sell the bond and actually experience a high capital gain. The bond could be worth, 130, 140 cents on the dollar because interest rates are so low. Now, again, I started this by saying everything else equal. The other thing that balances that off in the opposite direction is the assumed quality of the bond. So, in other words, as more and more suspicion is heaped on the quality of that debt instrument itself, that has a depressing effect on the value of the bond. In a sense of saying, if a person is uncomfortable with those type of obligations, this might be a golden opportunity for them to sell the bond and perhaps experience a good price on the bond sale because interest rates are so low, assuming that that interest rate effect is overwhelming what might be a negative effect from the credit quality, the credit suspicion.
Okay. I think that maybe the caller has a follow-up because we've got her back here on line number four, so I want to get back to her. Are we getting at your question?
Certainly the first part of it, but you ask how I particularly came across these bonds, and they were recommended to me by a broker. And one of the concerns, of course, is that some of them are very long-term, coming due in 35 years.
So they're recent purchases?
Yes, within the last, I think, 2 or 3 years.
Okay, well, again, perhaps before your call, the one mention I made is, in my opinion, today is the worst time in an interest rate environment, in an interest rate cycle. Today's the worst time to go out and buy long-term securities in an attempt to lock in a high rate of return. I know it's painful to look at the yields that are present in shorter-term maturities, but the price risk, much less any potential default risk, credit quality, ratings downgrade risk. The ratings downgrade and default risk I put in a near-term category in terms of risk potential. The next 12 to 36 months, In terms of interest rate risk, I mean, when you expose yourself to a 30, 35-year fixed rate bond, when interest rates are at historical lows, you're almost setting up the proposition of seeing the value of those bonds decline precipitously at some point in the future, 5 years, 7 years, 10 years from now, when the bond still has 20 or 25 years to mature, and now interest rates are at levels twice as high as present.
Right, right.
See, so that math works in reverse. If interest rates return to some more normal levels, the value of those bonds, because of that, will decline.
Right, and of course the problem with the purchase of equities in the last 10 years has made, as you mentioned already, bonds very attractive. What I'm wondering, though, in terms of the default question, is the fact that these bonds are insured, but I don't know who they're insured by, so I don't know if the insurance amounts to anything.
Well, we've seen over the past 2 years, 2.5 years now, that insurance is only as good as the underwriter.
Right.
There are companies that insure bonds, that have insured bonds for 30, 35 years. They have a long history of operating. And you know what? In 2008, the capability of their standing good on their guarantees was tested severely. What that did not do was keep the price of those insured bonds from collapsing. Okay? The issuer itself may never have gone into default. The insurer itself may never have needed to make payments to the bondholders, but the mere financial, condition of the insurer itself was so suspect that insured municipal bonds were tarnished, and the secondary market priced in the risk of an eventual not being able to cover in the event of default type of probability. Again, I'm not trying to paint a picture. I'm not a Cassandra here to tell you that the sky is falling or anything else. That's the furthest thing from it.
Right.
But I think an investor needs to know that a recommendation is a recommendation. You need to put it through your own sieve, your own approach to what is common sense and how does it fit my objectives, and more importantly, how does it fit my risk tolerance? I've got to be able to sleep at night. 1,012 years ago when I started out in this business, I used to tell people, look, most of the time we're struck making decisions that balance this, conundrum. Do you want to sleep well or do you want to eat well?
Right.
That's kind of the best way I can summarize it. So again, put it through your own sense of logic. Test the hypothesis against basic math. It's a fact. When interest rates rise, fixed income long-term maturity bonds experience the most dramatic price change. It's totally moot and irrelevant if you are not bothered by that, because you have every intention of holding the bond to maturity. And your assumption is, 3 years from now, the financial condition of those obligations will be in much better stead. I mean, I can come to a recommendation to purchase those bonds today, too. But again, it's got to be in the context of what are your objectives? What are your constraints? Do you want to sleep well? Do you want to eat well? It's kind of down to that.
And it made sense at the time that I made the purchase. That's part of the problem. But one of the things we know about any investment is how it can change and how rapidly it can change. And so that's what I'm facing right now, most particularly the risk of inflation.
Well, inflation is only a subcomponent of basically the increase in interest rates. But you've hit on another element. I mean, even if inflation never materializes or metastasizes as being a significant problem in the coming 30 to 35 years, it's difficult for me to imagine an environment of a healthy economy where interest rates remain at the current level. Do you understand?
Right.
Do you understand the point I'm trying to make? Inflation is just another element. It's a very concerning element. But without even going there, I'm just going to say, does it make sense? I mean, if you think of the bonds price as the inverse of an interest rate, that's kind of the reason I'd like to make an analogy to the stock market. Do you feel good buying stocks when the Dow is at 12,000 or 9,000?
Right.
Okay. So in effect, buying fixed income, long-term to maturity bonds in the present environment is like buying stocks when the Dow is at 12,000, not like when it's buying it at 9,000. Now, if you can tell me that the Dow is going to go from 12 to 18,000, we can be happy. I don't think we can make the same analogy in the bond market to say that interest rates can go from 0% to negative.
Right. Well, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you for the call. We have somebody else here. We'll get right to you. Our guest in this hour of Focus, Kevin Waspy. He's a lecturer in finance in the College of Business here at the U of I, and he is here as our person for this month for our regular show on money management and personal finance. And if you have specific, the idea of this show is that if you have a specific question about your own situation, and you're like the last caller, you have some doubts or some questions about what you're doing with your money, you can call in and tell Kevin about it, and he'll tell you what he thinks. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And here's someone in Champaign right here. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
Thanks for not going fishing.
Oh, thank you.
Well, everybody's got to go fishing sometime or another.
Okay. Or call it that. In terms of what is the current rate of inflation?
How would you like to measure it?
I don't care the right way.
Well, I'm not trying to be flippant.
Oh, I know.
But that's the $64,000 question back in the 50s. How do we measure inflation? Well, there was a report out this morning on the consumer price index. There was a report out yesterday on the producer price index. So whether we're trying to measure it at the wholesale level like yesterday or the retail level like today, those are the most widely known ways of measuring a rate of inflation in the United States. Now, there are a host of other economic series that are reported. We could talk about things like the trade-weighted GDP price deflator and all of these other kind of esoteric measures. But I like to turn it back and ask you, what's your rate of inflation? Do you know how to calculate that?
Well, the difficulty there is that I know that if you're eating out in terms of food, it seems there's been a fair inflation there for some reason. I don't know why.
Well, and again, it's all anecdotal evidence unless we keep some records. So I'm a big believer in budgeting, and I'm a big believer in measuring, and only then can I come to an answer that makes some sense for my purpose. Bottom line is this. I know from my budgeting and I know from my review of expenditures, generally speaking, over the past 12 months, those things that are obligations that I must pay cost me more, and they cost me about 9% more. Mm. Those things include things like the taxes that I'm paying, whether it's property taxes, retail sales tax I'm paying, the utility tax that I'm paying every time I pay a power bill, a cable TV bill, a telephone bill, whatever. Those things that I call the obligations that I have no control over are certainly higher than any measured rate of inflation. If you wanted to go to the Department of Commerce website and see the this morning's report on CPI or yesterday's report, the components used in constructing those measures, in my opinion, for the average person living a day-to-day life are pretty misguiding in terms of a rate of inflation. As a general economic series, it might have implication in some aspect, but long answer to your very good question, and I hate to bore the tears out of your eyes, but I think inflation is higher for those things that most people have to pay than any measured amount of inflation.
Well, this brings me to the next one in terms of tips. It seems that, you know, that the rate of interest, of the it's a combination of what, inflation and interest, I guess?
Right. Treasury, the tips that you've mentioned, Treasury securities that are indexed for inflation basically work with a very, very low fixed coupon rate of interest, and then they adjust the principal amount based on the reported measure of inflation using the CPI. So the principal amount you own is a growing factor based on that indicator of inflation.
But now, can those, it seems those are carrying a pretty good combination rate, or at least they were. Can you actually lose on those? I mean, they're your principal?
To your first statement, the comparability of a rate of return to a straight U.S. Treasury fixed income, no adjustment to principal type of security, that's kind of ebbs and flows. It's fun to watch the disparity between those two rates of return. It's almost like an indicator itself on the market's implied or assumed rate of future inflation. It's kind of a neat thing to study. But to your point, that difference ebbs and flows. It widens and narrows. At the moment, tips are not considered to be very attractive. But at the moment, the current market and the current environment is one of not feeling too fearful for any inflation of any measured amount, again, CPI, PPI type of measures, to be problematic in the coming 3 to 5 years. That's the market's assessment. If a person wanted to include tips as a component in their fixed income portfolio, I think they serve a very good purpose in that spectrum, in the component of saying, well, this is my sort of hedge against some higher level of inflation. And like every other strategy that you'd either hear me or David Sinnoh discuss, you're going to hear the word diversification, which means taking a look at the different components that would go together to form what you would call, or I would call, your complete portfolio. And I think tips fit a part of that complete portfolio.
And just finally, I've heard, certainly whether where I heard or whatever, but that the banks, you know, they're getting a really low, they can go, to the Treasury and get very low rate, right, to borrow money.
Well, banks are actually getting their lowest source of funds right now from the depositor. And what I would ask you to do is look at any financial institution and see what they're paying you on a six-month CD. If they go to the Fed's discount window or a correspondent bank and borrow short-term reserves overnight, literally overnight funding, it's costing them 25 basis points, 0.25% on an annualized basis. The deposit rates they're paying you on six-month CDs are probably less than that. So the cost of funds to banks, yes, are at record lows, and you, the depositor, or any other saver, are the source of that low source, that low cost of funds.
And they're making 3% or what?
Well, if a bank goes out and buys a 10-year Treasury note today, they're getting a 2.94% yield. Now there's a hell of a there's a heck of a risk between, you know, paying a depositor on a 6 month rate and then investing those funds in a 10-year instrument. So it's not an apples to apples comparison, but by and large, what I'm agreeing with you is banks right now have some of the juiciest, the widest interest spreads in the history of banking.
I want to jump in here. I want to appreciate the callers' comments, questions. We had several other people here. We're already at our midpoint with Kevin Wasby, and this is our monthly show on personal finance. So if you have a question, you can call us 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And you may also email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. Up next, we will talk with someone in Champaign. Line 2. Hello. Yes, go ahead.
I'm not sure if this is an appropriate question. You can let me know if it's not. But I inherited a IRA from my father who passed away. I was listed as the sole beneficiary on this IRA. But in the will, note, he wants me to split this with my other four siblings. What is the easiest way or the best way for me to do that?
I wonder if I missed a few words in your telephone call. Did I hear that you are the sole beneficiary on the IRA, but under the terms of the will, the specific money in the IRA was, how should we say, to be split between you and siblings?
Correct.
Was there an attorney involved in the settling of this estate?
No, not really. There is an attorney involved. I mean, the settling of the estate isn't that complicated. It's just this one IRA is just something that I'm trying to deal with outside of using the attorney. And I've been given some suggestions, but I just heard your program on this morning, and I thought I would see what your suggestion was.
Well, my suggestion is to use the knowledge of an attorney, but for free. Here's my opinion. The governing document is the IRA.
Right.
And if the IRA has a single sole beneficiary, depending upon how your father structured the payments,
right,
or deemed the payments to be received by a beneficiary, that's the governing document.
Okay.
And anything different from that will raise the hackles of the Internal Revenue Service.
Okay.
If you want to handle between you and your siblings an economic solution to assets in the estate not encumbered by the IRA as a governing document for a portion of funds. I mean, that's between you and your siblings in saying, well, let's set up the sheets like this. Here's the value of the IRA that Mary gets. Here's the value of the estates outside of the IRA that all siblings share in equally. And who has to pay whom to make it equal such that the intention is to distribute the grand sum of the IRA and other assets equally to all siblings. Does that make sense? And that's the gentleman's agreement between, how should we say, all parties to the will.
Okay.
But you're not going to tell the IRA trustee or custodian to now put these numbers of people in the distribution process of that IRA. That isn't going to happen.
Okay.
Now that's okay. Now that opinion is worth what you paid for it.
Okay.
So okay. Again, I'm going to go back to my basic thesis and say you probably ought to invest a little bit of Don't be penny wise and pound foolish. Invest a little bit of expertise, and have an attorney help you settle this estate correctly.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Very
thank
good.
You very much.
And we'll go on to Spring Bay, line 4. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. If this is a little bit off track, just disregard it. But I wanted to go back to the inflation, deflation, because everything that I read warns of a deflationary period of time. We've lost $7 trillion in the housing market, commercial real estate, rents are going down. Unemployment is high. There doesn't look to be any new stimulus coming, so that means maybe a lot of states and municipalities will be laying off more public employees. Teachers are being laid off. Quantitative easing with making it printing more dollars could have the effect of actually making negative interest rates. So I'll throw all that out for you to respond to, and I'll get off and listen to the rest of the conversation.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
There's no question that the discussion of a potential deflationary period is prevalent now. We're seeing all of the conditions the caller mentioned. That's true. Will it turn into being a deflation problem? Golly, if I could answer that question and make trades appropriate to being correct, I guess that would make me the wealthiest guy in the world. Again, not to be flippant. Yes, that's a common theme nowadays. My personal opinion is we are going through a time right now that is different than I think any other time in our economic history. And I say different. It's not another 1930s depressionary period, okay? There are elements about what's going on now that are worse than those times. There are elements of today's environment that are a heck of a lot better than during the 1930s. And that's why I say it's different. It is a precarious position. We have the potential for experiencing a deflationary period of time that might last 5, 7, 10 years. I think all of those things, again, tell me that now is not the time to speculate as to what exactly will happen. It's probably ever more important to think about those things and put them in the context of, A, what makes sense for my objectives and my constraints, and B, why would I look at making a bet and putting a disproportionate amount of money contingent on this extreme, this outlier event actually coming to fruition? And the answer is, unless we're purposely making that speculatory position on that payoff potential, it's ever more a time where you look at what's available, you do the best with it, and you remain diversified within trying to fulfill your objectives and staying inside your constraints.
Well, it strikes me that, you know, when you get in times like this, then people with an almost magical fervor go looking for things that they think are going to hold their value no matter what. And that's why it is, you know, maybe the last, I don't know how long, there are some people who are just going nuts about gold. Or who knows what it is. There's something that they say, this is the magical thing, because
sure,
no matter what else happens, this thing does not lose its value. Now, if money is losing its value, if everything is losing its value, you know, if prices are going down, hey, that's swell. But if the value of your money is going down too, well, that maybe is not really helpful. Is that, though, what do you say to the person who is chasing the magical thing that never loses its value?
Well, a little bit like chasing the unicorn. If you can see it, that's the easiest part of it. Now, executing and actually catching that unicorn, that's the difficult part. So I've never been a believer in a magic potion. And to a certain extent, the David Inge strategy or the David Inge hope that you just expressed is a fantasy. I don't think there is a magic potion. And I don't think you're going to be able to catch a unicorn. So, you know, go for it. And, you know, if you achieve, congratulations, I'll toast you. But I'm not going to chase with you.
Okay. Let's go to Champagne, line 3, for another call. Hello.
Is that me?
Yes.
Okay. My wife and I have 4 CDs. One due in 14 years, and the other one due in 18. And the coupons range from 5.5% to 6.25%. So I'm wondering, A, would you recommend just holding on to them? And they are on the brokerage statement that I'm looking at here. There's unrealized gains listed, but they add up to considerably less than 1% of the total value of the CDs. And I'm wondering, with such relatively high interest rates, why aren't they worth more than they are?
Well, you answered my first question I was going to ask when you said on the brokerage statement. I was going to say, how in the world did you find 14 and 18-year term to maturity certificates of deposit? But now I know they're brokered CDs.
Right.
The reason you're not going to see the kind of similar type of price performance with those as you would with something like a plain vanilla fixed rate corporate or U.S. Treasury type of bond is because they're not free market trading instruments.
So they'd be hard to sell, in other words.
Well, yeah. They're going to have a limited marketplace.
Uh-huh.
And we know that when things trade in a less liquid market, the difference between the bid and the ask, the bid being what you could sell them at, the ask being what you'd have to pay for them at the same moment, is huge. The marketplace for those is just not a marketplace that warrants buying and selling. It warrants buying and holding. So, now, that said, think about the prospect of that rate of return relative to today's environment. And let me ask you, could you go out and look and see if you could find a comparable 14-year, 18-year, high-quality corporate type of debt that has a 4.5 or thereabouts type of rate of return? And my answer is, yeah, you can probably find something like that. So, you see, you're not too far away from par in that context. Now, again, it's a CD, so we're going to say, yes, it's insured by the FDIC and all of that rigmarole malarkey. But the reason I say rigmarole and malarkey is you got to read the terms of the FDIC insurance pretty closely, because if a financial institution that issues a CD, regardless of the term, gets in trouble and literally has failed, the FDIC will come in, and it's within their purview to literally terminate those obligations. So there's a possibility that they could hand you your money back and your whatever fixed rate of interest on it disappears. So I'm not saying that the bank that issued those CDs is going to fail, don't get me wrong. But on the one hand, we say they're FDIC insured, so the U.S. government's going to stand against the loss of principal. That's true. The other thing you've got to realize is the federal government can also change the terms of your instrument in the event the bank gets in trouble. So you get with one, you give up with the other. Does that make sense?
You mean that the FDIC, if one of these banks went under, could just
pay off all the depositors. Pay off all the depositors. Every Friday in the, the Wall Street Journal now comes on Saturday too, and I can't get used to that. But in every Saturday's Wall Street Journal on page C2, you'll see a small box in usually the lower left-hand corner of which banks were closed this week. In many instances, the banks are, the customers of the bank are assumed by a new banking institution.
Right.
So the FDIC gets out its shotgun, and it finds a wedding partner. And the deposits of ABC Bank now assumed by XYZ Bank. And same for the loans. You're basically dealing with a new bank. Every once in a while, one of those banks won't, even despite the size of the shotgun the FDIC pulls out, they can't find a wedding partner, so they will dissolve the bank, and that literally means paying off all of the depositors. And that's it. You get your money back.
Right.
That's the terms of the deal. But we're not going to pay you 4.5% on the money for the next 14 years.
Yeah, I think I was aware of that. Okay, so basically you'd say hang on to them because you might not be able to sell them anyway.
Well, I'm saying if you're happy with the yield and they fit your objectives, if you don't worry about them either being taken away or the fact that there are alternatives that might suit your purposes as well and provide greater liquidity, I mean, that's up to you. If you're good with them, sounds to me like you're sleeping well at night.
Yeah, so far.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Continued good luck with that. Let's go to Champagne for another caller here. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. In line with your discussion about fixed securities, I wanted to ask you about a specific one, and you could tell me whether you will or won't talk about it. I was interested in talking about the Ginnie Mae Fund in the Vanguard system, since that is, in one sense, it's a bond fund. It does have it says its average maturity is 2.4 years, which that seems to be good based on what you said earlier. But I wanted to hear what you thought about that, since that does go up and down in value in addition to the fluctuation in the interest rates.
Right. And that's a great question. You've pointed out something that has become very prevalent, very popular even, among investors, and that's using a mutual fund to purchase things that are, government-backed. Now, when we talk about a Ginnie Mae fund, a government national mortgage association, it's a pool of mortgages guaranteed the payment of interest and principal by the federal government. And we could say to ourselves, well, in theory, on that stead, there's no default risk. That's cool. When you look at the mutual fund, and the mutual fund says the average life of the Ginnie Mae pools they own are currently 2.5 years, remember that a mutual fund is never ending. Okay, so every time there's a maturity, they go out and they use those funds then if they don't have to use them to pay out withdrawals to the mutual fund shareholders, they obviously go out and reinvest. Now, is it within the prospectus? Is it their charter? Is it their purpose to maintain that type of average maturity? Have you looked at the prospectus?
Right, yeah. It calls itself intermediate government funds, and it says they typically maintain a dollar-weighted average maturity of 3 to 10 years.
Okay. Well, then I would say if that's their constraints, 3 to 10 years, and they're currently at 2.5, they're, you know, I don't want to sound haughty. Don't take this the wrong way, but they're managing it, I think, very prudently. Maybe the way I would manage it, they're keeping short, given the low rate of interest we're in right now, the kind of environment we're in right now. If they were at the top end of their range, you know, out near 10% or 10 years, excuse me. 10 years or beyond, I'd say, oh, my God, they're reaching for yield and they're trying to keep their shareholders happy at the expense of a huge potential decline in value. So that said, whether it's Vanguard or any other reputable firm that is managing that type of portfolio in this current environment that way, I don't have a lot of fear for it. I would, as you did, remind myself frequently that it does have a variable value. So if interest rates rise, even though it's only 2.5 years average short type paper, you will see some decline in value. One rule of thumb, if I could give this to you or any other listeners, this is a rough rule of thumb, but it's decent. If you look in the prospectus, they'll talk about the average term to maturity with a fixed income mutual fund. They may, in most instances, they do disclose what the duration is. If you use that number, duration, and you multiply it by 1, that will give you a rough rule of thumb as to the value percent change in value that you should expect when interest rates move 1 percentage point. And it's, again, it's a rough rule of thumb. We're not actually doing hardcore bond math here, but it gives you a sense of saying if the net asset value of the fund is $10 today, for example, and instantaneously, overnight, I woke up and found interest rates exactly 1 percentage point higher in the marketplace of all interest rate potentials as compared to yesterday when I went to sleep, then the value of my fund shares should be 1 times the duration with a minus sign in front of it, percent lower in value.
So they, for instance, they list average duration 2.6 years.
Okay, so take 2.6 and tell yourself that if interest rates go up 1% immediately, overnight, and across the board, the value of your fund shares falls 2.6%.
Okay. Now, of course, the likelihood of it going up 1% overnight is
exactly. Small. Exactly. And that's why I was saying it's a rough rule of thumb. If you said 2 years from now, 3 years from now, interest rates were 3 percentage points higher than they are right now, 3 times 2.6, assuming no change in the composition of the portfolio, assuming a parallel and static shift in the yield curve, so no bending or reshaping of it, assuming, you know, then we could do that math.
Okay, thank you.
But it's something better than nothing to give you a rough gauge of the volatility of a fixed income investment.
Okay, about 5 minutes left here with Kevin Wasby. He's a lecturer in the Department of Finance in the U of I College of Business. We do this program once a month on a Friday to answer questions about personal finance. We have a couple of other callers. We'll try to get them both. The next in line is in Savoy, line two. Hello.
Hello. Yes, my question is this. My husband is at full Social Security age, and he's taking his Social Security now. And I'm eligible to start taking Social Security also if I want to take it early because I'm 3 years younger than my husband. So I'm wondering what would be wiser, to wait to take mine till I'm full Social Security age or to start taking it early. But if I take it early, then I've reduced permanently my amount of Social Security. But if I take it early, maybe I could buy CDs and be investing that way. So I'm not quite sure what the best thing to do is.
That's a great question. I would really, really defer that to the people in the Social Security office. Now, they're not going to be able to answer. They're not going to want to touch the question about, well, if I draw now, I could use that money to buy investments and blah, blah, blah. But what they are going to be good at is literally looking at your circumstance, both you and your husband, talking about things like, here are the benefits available now. This is what happens in a year. This is what happens in 2 years, 3 years, so on and so forth. Have you gone to the Social Security office and had that discussion?
Yes. She did give me a printout that ran off what my Social Security would be if I started taking it now as opposed to my full Social Security age. It's about a $200 difference.
Okay. Well, now, not to sound morbid, but the difference now gets into saying two things. One is a time value of money notion, and the other is a longevity notion. Obviously, the morbid part goes to longevity. How long do you think you'll live? And if the three-year, how should we say, deferral becomes a significant part of your total life expectancy, well, then obviously it makes sense economically to draw now rather than wait. If, however, 3 years becomes, how should we say, a pittance in what total life you will experience, then it puts it into a much lesser desirable draw-it-now category. The other thing to remember, and this is the pure rate of return analogy or let's just say time value of money concept, at the present environment, given the fact that there is very low rate of return potential with investment opportunities if you were drawing now, it doesn't sound like you're missing a great opportunity by postponing.
Excuse me for just a moment. I worry about inflation, too, eating up, you know, if I take it early and I have less. And in the wait time period, if I waited, inflation would have taken me down somewhat, too.
Well, and then again, I'll go back to one of the things I mentioned earlier this morning. 1,012 years ago, I used to tell people, do you want to eat well or do you want to sleep well?
Right.
If you fear for something, you know, you want to sleep well, act accordingly.
So what do you think then about now or later, or is it a toss-up?
I see no compelling reason to go one way or the other. So I've thrown it back in your lap.
Okay.
Do you want to eat well or do you want to sleep well?
Okay. Well, it looks like I could go either way. I think we're eating well enough, so that's why I was thinking maybe I should wait. But with the earnings on CDs and other things now, it seemed like it is a toss-up. So you think maybe either way?
Well, I don't think the loss of income or the deferral of income, let me put it that way.
Okay.
I don't think the deferral of income is keeping you from purchasing anything that's an outrageous opportunity at the moment.
Okay. All right. Do you think there's any change in that situation in the foreseeable future, like the next couple years?
I find that difficult to answer.
Okay.
If I could tell you where the stock market would be in 18 months or 2 years or a year tomorrow, tomorrow's Saturday. I can tell you where the stock market's going to be tomorrow. But if I felt like I could pinpoint a turn of events to that level, we'd all be happy.
So either way, I could do better or worse. Is that more or less what you're thinking? I mean, we don't have a crystal ball.
The possibility of being better off, I think, is more determined by your life experience.
Okay.
Okay, so again, even I'll take it to the morbid side. The more pressing determinant of which would have been a better decision, if we could do this ex post, 1,000 years from now, we look back and say, which would have been the better decision? The biggest driver in answering that question would be, how long did she live?
Right, okay. That's kind of what I was thinking, too. You know, it's kind of like gambling in a way, basing it on what you think your life expectancy might be. Well, all right, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, there, we're going to have to leave it. I'm sorry, we got one person we can't take, but for this time around, we've used the time, and we will do it again in another month. For the moment, we say thanks very much to Kevin Waspy. He's a lecturer in finance in the College of Business here at the U of I. Thank you.
Thank you, David. It's always fun to be here. And have a good weekend.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Music Shop and Pro Sound Center, now located at 27 East Market View Drive in Market View Plaza, Champaign. The Music Shop offers private lessons on all instruments through Champaign School of Music, located on the premises. They also provide a complete band and orchestra instrument repair and service department.
And right now we'll take a break, as we usually do, for an update on the markets. We'll be back. Stay tuned.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where it's been tug and pull all morning at the Chicago Board of Trade. First prices down, then they're up, and now they're down about where they were off of the opening bell. Let's look at the particulars. In Kansas City, September wheat at 5.93¾, down 12. December 6.10¾, down 12¼. September wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade at 5.81¼, down 15. December 6.09½, down 15. September corn 3.90, down 2½. December 4.03, down 2¼. March 4.13½, down 2½. May 4.20¾, down 2½. July 4.26½, down 3½. August soybeans 10.17, down 2. September 9.96, down 5. November 9.83, down 5. January 9.90½, down 4½. March 9.92½, down 4. May 9.92, down 2¾. August soybean meal at 305.80 is down 1.80. August soybean oils at 38.39, down 20.